Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We finally come to the end of the Ten Commandments. This is the last one. I think it's a very significant one. I think it has some tremendous implications. And this has been kind of a hard study for me. I'm more of a historical background person and context person and word study and grammar. It's been somewhat difficult for these very short verses to do them. So I hope that you have used some other materials that may have been helpful and look for applications the Spirit gave you leadership. This last one has some very significant applications, particularly in the New Testament. So let's go through it as a general background to it, a word spray study, application truths, and discussion questions. Okay? Basic introduction. It is possible to see a connection between the last five commandments. Some see commandment number 6, 7, and 8 in related to the fact that you shall not injure your covenant partner by an action or a deed. They see that commandment number 9 prohibits the injury of a covenant partner or neighbor by a word or thought or false testimony. Then number 10 prohibits the injury of a covenant partner in thought. Now, I agree that sounds very good, but the only hang-up about that is that basically coveting does not hurt your neighbor. It destroys you. It's the lust of your heart, the desires of your flesh that causes internal struggle that many of us face. So therefore, I'm not sure that is a real valid thing. It is quite possible that this word to covet incorporates in itself the idea not only of an evil thought, but of the necessary steps to procure that which is desired. Now, if that is true, I think that this relationship between these last five would hold water. Many see this commandment as extremely unique among all the ancient law codes of the ancient Near East. We discussed many of them in a previous lesson. And they would say it's unique in this way. Now, here's the commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servants or his female servants or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now, here we're not so much primarily prohibiting an action unless the action is assumed in the verb to covet or the word to covet. But what we're assuming is the thought life. Do you mean this is a commandment against an attitude, against a mental activity? Well, it seems to be that. Although I think in context it implies the steps to acquire something. Now, it is true that the Hebrew mind thought about this concept of the thought life quite often. And there are two passages that I think are very relevant to this, and I want to read them. The first one is found in Proverbs 23:7, a very famous line. I want you to hear this. For as he thinks within himself, so is he. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he, is King James. Do you mean that I really am what I think about? Yeah, and that gets scary, doesn't it? Well, there's one more, I think, that relates to that. And that's in the New Testament book of James, chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. Listen to this New Testament wisdom literature. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. And when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Now, the ancient rabbis would say that the eyes and the ears are the window of the soul. And what we let in through the eyes and the ears takes root in the seedbed of our lives. And it grows and grows, and the fruit of that will be us working out in the real world, in actions and deeds, that which we've begun to think on. Now, if that's the concept here, then you can see how it's related to actions. There are several passages where the word, the Hebrew word covet, in the same verse is linked to the action of procuring or taking or seizing or snatching that which is coveted. Let me give you several of them. It shows that this verb does have more than just thought. Deuteronomy 7:25, Joshua 7:21, and Micah 2:2 are one, are several of many that seem to imply this, but to me these were the clearest. If it is true that emphasis is placed on that which is listed first or that which is listed last, and you apply that truth to the Ten Commandments, it becomes an obvious kind of corollary. The first commandment dealt with the priority of God, and the last commandment deals with the priority of the thought life in the area of acquiring things at a neighbor's or covenant partner's expense. It was interesting to me as I was preparing this lesson that this seems to be the same basic truth linking a love for God with an appropriate response to things, be it material possessions or that which we sense we desire, love and fellowship and all. In Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, particularly chapter 6, verses 19 through 32 say, "Be anxious for nothing and who can add," and all that. But the key is in 33. "But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." I think it's significant that our desire for things is really a lack of faith in God's provision and care. And it's been a central problem of man. Now, that's a kind of basically some introductory statements to get our mind churning. Now let's go to the text itself. And it's interesting to me that the text of Deuteronomy 5:21, though not significantly different from Exodus 20:17, is noticeably different in a couple of areas. It's very important we notice those areas, okay? Number one, in Deuteronomy 20:17, you may have noticed that a man's wife was included in a list of possessions. Now, first of all, let me say, I know women are starting to jump around the room. This is an ancient culture. It's a patriarchal system. Don't judge it in light of our culture and our system. For the word house basically means in Hebrew a man's household or everything connected with his household. And a wife, of course, is one of those things in an ancient culture that a man possessed. I think there are many passages in the Old Testament that speak of the love of Jewish men for their wives and their appreciation of them. So I don't think it's a put down of wives, but it is a covenant, a cultural sense that they were part of a man's property. However, in Deuteronomy 5:17, the wife seems to be pulled out of the list of household objects and placed in a category by herself, apparently a priority category. And I think that's significant. We could also quibble the fact that a man owned slaves, and we could say, was that ever right? But you got to remember, we judge the Scripture in light of its own culture, let its own culture speak, and then take the universal truths and apply it to ours. Everything the Bible records, it does not advocate. Because Exodus 20 puts wife in property doesn't mean that to be biblical, our wife has to be our property any more than we have to have slaves to be biblical. So, don't get your bippy all upset at this point. I also want to mention that in Exodus 20, the Hebrew word for covet is used twice. While in Deuteronomy 5, there is two words. Covet is one of them, but the second word is desire. Now, covet seems to imply a desire for something and then taking the steps to acquire what one desires. So it implies thought that proceeds into action. But now the Hebrew word desire, which is used in Deuteronomy 5:21, primarily focuses on the mind or the thoughts alone. Now, it's hard to draw that tight of a distinction between these synonyms because Hebrew, being an ancient language, doesn't have the fine distinctions and connotations that a more developed language like Greek, New Testament written in, or English would have. And yet, I think you can find the usage of these terms seems to be somewhat set. Now, I also want to mention that Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, in my opinion, are primarily different because Exodus 20, as you know, was preparing the people as they left Mount Sinai. And God, of course, knew that they were going to wander for 40 years because that is what he's going to do with them because of their unbelief at Kadesh Barnea in entering the Promised Land. And so Exodus 20 is primarily the Ten Commandments as it reflects a nomadic, or at least semi-nomadic, existence. But Deuteronomy 5, which is primarily the five summary sermons of Moses on the plains of Moab on the eastern side of the Jordan just before they cross over the Jordan under Joshua, is primarily preparing them for a more settled existence within the Promised Land, or Canaan, or Palestine. And therefore, there is a slight variation. And so in Deuteronomy 5, it is unique that the word field occurs in the list of possessions where it does not occur in Exodus 20. And of course, that's obvious. They didn't have any fields in their nomadic existence, but they're going to have land allocated to the different tribes. And so a field will become part of the possessions. And I think that's significant. Now, I want to mention here before I go any further that the word covet in Hebrew, and I think the same concept in Greek, is more of a neutral term. It doesn't have to be bad. I'll give you two examples. In Psalms 19:10, we are to desire the word of God. In 1 Corinthians 12:31, we are to desire the greater spiritual gifts. And so I think you can see it's neutral. It's the context of wanting to take that which is your covenant partner's, to take from him in whatever way, is to walk on him so as to get you satisfied. That's the real problem. Improper desire, I think, is the root cause of man's sin. Now, it's often said that pride is the root cause of sin, or self is the root cause of sin. And I think that's true, but when you see it in a little different light, it's really this sense of coveting or desiring what others have. I think it's what caused the fall of Satan. Now, obviously, I don't know much about the fall of Satan. The Bible does not talk a lot about the origin of evil or the angelic conflict. But it does seem to me that as you look at Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, that goes beyond the king of Tyre and the king of Babylon. And we do see something of the evil one, who apparently a high created archangel coveted God's own place and fell because of that evil desire toward wanting to be God. Well, lo and behold, that's exactly what Adam and Eve do. Didn't the serpent tell Eve that she would be like God, her eyes would be opened, and God was trying to keep something from her? And lo and behold, Eve did that, and Adam followed. So here again is the coveting the place of God. And I think it's not only Satan and Adam and Eve that has that problem, it's fallen man in general. For fallen man has been affected. We are all affected by Adam, Romans 5, 12 and following. I think this can uniquely be seen in the life and ministry of Paul. And I want to read from Paul in Romans chapter 7. If you know Romans 7, it's Paul's great struggle with sin, particularly Romans 7, 7 and 8. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except the law, for I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, thou shalt not covet. But sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind. For apart from the law, sin is dead. So there is Paul struggling with this concept of mental temptation. Basically, I think coveting is a lack of contentment in what God has provided us and will provide us, and a lack of trusting faith that God's going to do the best for us. And we feel like we got to get it for ourselves, you know, actualize our potential, go out there and do our thing, instead of the quiet, simple trust the New Testament and the Old Testament, for that matter, advocates. American individual aggressive competitiveness is exactly 180 degrees opposite from the biblical truth. Now, other thing I want to say, there are several New Testament passages that seem to relate to this concept of coveting, and I want to read some of them to you. Man's problem is discontentment and greed. Now, Jesus said that, and the place is Luke 12:15. Now, I hope you'll turn there with me because you might want to mark these or at least mark them in your Bibles. Listen to what Jesus said. Beware and be on guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. The parable of the guy who wanted to build more barns is a good idea. He was wanting more and more and more, and God said, "Thou fool, tonight thy soul will be required of thee." I saw the same thing when I was looking over here in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 8 through 10. Will you turn there with me? 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 8 through 10. And listen as Paul talks about this concept of coveting. If we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pain. And I think we've all seen that happen in the lives of people. Now, secondly, I want to mention that coveting is included in Jesus' list of major sins that defile a man. So if you'll turn back over me to Mark chapter 7, this is a very significant verse to me because it deals with the concept that it's not what goes in a man, food or drink, that defiles him. It's what comes out. And in this context, of verse 17 through 23, Jesus interprets the parable that he had just told the people. And when leaving the multitude, he entered the house. His disciples questioned him about the parable. And he said to them, "Are you too so uncomprehending? Do you not see that whatever goes into a man from outside cannot defile him, because it goes into his heart, but into his stomach, and is eliminated? Thus he declared all foods clean." And he was saying, "That which proceeds out of the man, that is what defiles the man. For from within, out of the heart of men proceed evil thoughts, fornication, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All these evil things proceed from within and defile the man." And as you picked up, coveting is certainly included there. Now, I thought about Paul, who also includes this very same thing, in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. I did not at all mean with immoral people of this world, but with the covetous and swindlers or with idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world. Now, all I want to say there is he mentions covetousness in this concept of sins that defile. And the same truth is seen again over in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 5. Notice this. "For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous person who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God." This same thing, this same list is found in Colossians 3, 5, where coveting is called idolatry. And I think you ought to see that. Now some application truths. Let's discuss what I've said. The answer to lustful greed and discontentment is love. Agape, self-giving love. And the place I think Paul expresses that best is over in Romans 13, after he's talked about himself struggling with coveting. I want to read Romans 13, verses 8 through 10. And you will follow with me. I think it really helps us to see this. "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there is any other command, it is summed up in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of the law." How do we stop coveting our neighbor's property, be it fame or possessions or reputation or whatever? We love him. One more. What's another way to battle this concept of lusting and coveting? Well, I think in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5, and I'm going to link that with Philippians 4, 11 through 13. Listen to this. "Let your way of life be free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. Oh, my. And then listen to the very famous one in the book of Philippians, chapter 4, verses 11, 13, as it deals with contentment is the answer. Love and contentment will solve the problem of coveting. Listen, Paul. Now, I speak, not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. And in any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. And then verse 14 is very important. Paul says, I've learned contentment. Look at this. Nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my affliction. How do you solve greed? How do you solve covetousness? You love your neighbor as yourself. You are content in whatever you have, and you share what you have with others. Oh, folks, this is an answer to the problem of coveting, if you'll just listen. Now, the command to stop coveting is in the Ten Commandments. But the means to stop coveting only come with our knowledge of Christ. The problem is, until we come to know Jesus and find ourselves accepted and content in God's provision and care, we're always going to desire what other people have. It always makes me amazing. We think we'll be happy if we just have what they have. Folks, if you're not happy with who you are and what you have, you'll never be happy with what somebody else has or who they are. Happiness is in you, not in others or in things. Till you learn that, you're just going to be miserable. Now, the other side of this I want to mention is that God knows what we think. Now, here's the problem. If our thought life is a concern to God, and God knows what we think, then we're going to have to clean up our thought life. Let me give you a few verses, if I could. You might write these down. There's several of them. 1 Chronicles 28:9. Proverbs 20:27. Psalms 139:1-23. Jeremiah 17:10. Romans 8:27 and Revelation 2:23, all of those verses together show us that God knows what we think. Well, you say, well, Bob, how can I control what I think? Now, listen to me. I think it's important. I think all of us are going to see something our neighbor has, and the thought's going to come across us, I wish I had that. I could do better with that than him. I deserve that more than him. I ought to take that from him. Now, whatever it is be, his wife, his donkey, his field, his reputation, his money, his mind, his body, whatever. I heard someone say, I think it's so true, you can't stop birds from flying over your head, but you can keep them from making nests in your hair. We're not going to be able to control our thought life as far as what comes in, because I think the evil one must be involved in that in some way. And our fallen mind produces a lot of junk. But it's when we dwell on them, it's when we plan on how to acquire and implement those evil thoughts, it's when we yield ourselves to that fallen truth that if I just had that, I'd be happy. I think we're all going to face these temptations that come across our mind, this coveting and lusting and greedful egotism we all struggle with. But I think Jesus can help us. And I think that if we can control our minds, or we wouldn't have a commandment to stop coveting, right? We can control our minds. We can't keep out the thoughts. Now, if thoughts are evil, all of us have sinned and continue to over and over. But I think that really it's the meditation on that evil, planning, enjoying that, that's the real problem. Now, I want to say something else to you. I hope you hear me. Things are not evil. Your neighbor's things are not evil. Things, be it possessions or reputations or gifts, spiritual gifts, whatever they are. Friends, when we long after those and they become priority and they become ultimate, and they become the goal of our lives, that's when they become evil. See, money's not evil. It's the love of money, the priority of money, the priority of things. Only God is priority. Only God is ultimate. Now, because God is ultimate, and He has put such a high price on men and women made in His image, then how we treat our covenant neighbor reflects what we think about God. Now, think about that. If we desire to rip off our brother, whom we have seen, and then we claim to love God whom we haven't seen, the book of 1 John says we're a liar. So be careful that you don't get consumed. And friends, America in the 20th century is ate up with materialism and consumerism. We just think we got to live far above everybody else. You don't. Matter of fact, I really think we ought to live under our means for the cause of Christ. So, coveting affects the covenant community in insidious and destructive ways. It destroys the brother who covets, and it works itself out into overt, hateful actions toward the brother whose things are coveted. Doesn't matter what it is. It's that root of bitterness, that cancer of the spirit, that will destroy your life if you don't deal with it in Jesus Christ. How do you deal with it? Love, contentment, sharing. Now, here's five discussion questions you might want to think about in connection with this lesson. See if you can answer these or if you use them in a classroom to stimulate discussion. What is coveting? How does modern man covet? Are our thoughts sin? Why are thoughts so significant in the Christian life? Why is the commandment somewhat different between Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5? These will get the discussion flowing. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.